Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. This is my conversation with Daniel Prince, who is host of the Once Bitten podcast and all-around interesting guy. I asked Daniel to come on specifically to talk about a topic that I'm particularly interested in, and that is education. I am at a stage of life where we'll be homeschooling my daughter, who is 5 years old this fall. And I've heard him talk. I heard him talk first on Saifedean's podcast a couple of years back, and love his approach, his philosophy. And I don't think there's anyone better at shedding light on the insanity of our current schooling paradigm than Daniel. And I think this was, first of all, personally, a very helpful conversation, but something that everyone needs to listen to and consider, as we all are lifelong learners, and particularly for those of you bringing up children as well. All righty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Daniel here. Daniel, welcome to the show.
How you doing, mate? Thanks for having me on, Michael.
I'm good. Hey, I'm really looking forward to this. I told you offline, this is sort of a selfish conversation for me. I have a 5-year-old daughter who is starting kindergarten, or I mean, I guess the grade doesn't really matter. She's beginning, I guess you could say, more formal schooling in the fall. And we're a few months out and trying to figure out the best way of approaching this. We have made the determination to homeschool. And my sense is, you probably, even amongst homeschoolers, you sort of have a unique perspective. I've downloaded your book to my Kindle. I usually like hard copy, but I'm going to be reading Choose Life while on the road. And so just want something accessible. I'd love to start, though, before we get into all of that exciting stuff, with just your background. I think you have a finance background, and I'm curious how you found Bitcoin, because I know that's, you know, this all sort of ties together. It's sort of a lifestyle decision that I think a lot of people make. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into the Bitcoin space.
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty basic, normal upbringing, southeast of the UK. Went through the local state schooling system, did all that stuff. I didn't go to university. I was lucky enough that it wasn't a prerequisite in those days. I entered the workforce in 1995 in foreign exchange markets in London. Just by proxy of, they needed somebody on the desk to run around and get them sandwiches and get their coffees and park their cars and do all of that kind of stuff. That was my big intro into the world of finance. And I just watched 16 guys sit around in a great big circle yelling and screaming at each other all day, just two numbers. And they signified the current price of dollars against Deutschmarks. And that was by far and away the biggest tradable market at that time, the most liquid market, and huge sums settled. And this is even before, like, nobody had a computer on their desktop. Nobody had an email address. This was literally just on the phones and yelling and screaming. And it was an incredible place to be, a very unique environment. You got caught up in it, for sure, especially when it was busy, like the adrenaline would really start pumping. And I could see that these guys were earning a lot of money. So that was like the dangled carrot over my head. It's like, if I just stick this trainee season out, then I'll be all good. A few years later, I'm still a trainee. I started getting onto the desk a little bit, you know, you'd holiday cover and things like that. And you'd start meeting some of the younger trainee traders. So you're starting to make a little network, and then the euro happened. And alongside that also happened AI, or basically just a little robot machine that could repeat two numbers better than a human being. And so I was thinking, oh my God, like, I was just about to get my chance and it's being rug pulled from, you know, in front of my nose. So I changed that career path and went into options broking, foreign exchange options, which still had to remain very much voice-based. It was a lot more technical than just two numbers. You're dealing with futures and many different dates out in the future rather than just spot. And that career took me to Singapore in 1999, where my now wife and I, we spent 15 years over there together, and we had all our kids over there together. And it got to a point after so many years in that business that I knew I just couldn't do it anymore. It was coming for an end to me, coming to an end for me. We'd had the four kids. I wasn't seeing the kids. I was a lodger in my own home at the weekends, and nothing seemed to make sense. And then I read the book, The 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss, which turned my head upside down. And it made me realize that I was just running on a hamster wheel that was designed for me to run on. And I was just this tiny cog in a huge machine. I had no idea of the mechanisms of how it really worked. I had no idea of the Cantillon effect. I had no idea. I didn't even know it was called a fiat currency. I'd brokered fiat currencies my whole career. They were just dollars, yen and euro. They weren't called fiat. And I'd seen the death of all of these other fiat currencies right under my nose. The Deutschmark, the franc, the Italian lira, the Spanish peseta, all of them gone. The Greek drachma, the Portuguese escudo. Yeah, out the window. Sorry, guys, we're not using those anymore. So when you hear other Bitcoiners talk about all fiat currencies trend to zero, you know, there's a, like, it's happened in my lifetime. Like, I don't know how many now. I think we're in the 20s of those currencies that have just gone to the wall and bought in under this one euro or euro dollar system. So once I'd realized that I was done with that, I had to start putting my mind to escaping. How are we going to get out of, you know, this corner which we've painted ourselves into? You know, good career in the eyes of many people. It paid well enough, but we were still trying to, you know, inflation was just ebbing everything away. Some long thinking sessions, deep thoughts, trying to find books, articles, blogs, YouTube videos of people that I could learn from or that we could learn from, and just trying to look at life in a completely different way. And that took, after reading the book, November 2013, we were gone by March 2014. So it was a pretty quick turnaround looking back on it. But at the time when you're in it, there are just so many thoughts spinning around in your mind. And that's when we took the kids out of school and we started traveling. And we traveled long term for like 2.5 years in the end. We didn't have a plan to do that. It just kind of transpired that way. It's amazing what happens when you just unplug yourself from these systems and you take self-control. And it was at that point that I truly started learning about Bitcoin, because I'd come across it several times prior, but had just completely pushed it aside. And I actually thought that it was dead, like done and dusted. And I can't remember why. Maybe Mt. Gox. When that happened, I just thought, like, that was the company that started it or something. You know, my level of understanding was very, very shallow. In fact, zero. And so once we had a little bit more time on our hands and I could sit down and think much deeper about how am I going to protect the assets that, you know, I'd worked for so long. How am I going to protect that? And at that point, it was in metals, stocks, bonds, the usual mix of stuff, right? Diversify and you'll be fine. And all of this kind of classic TradFi nonsense, to be quite frank. And that's when I found Bitcoin. And I found Bitcoin through Real Vision. Shout out to the early founders of Real Vision. One of them, Grant Williams, who founded it with Raoul Powell. And I think a lot of people listening know Raoul now and his stance, and he's very much a cryptard and he loves his cryptos. And it's a real shame to see, because Real Vision, when they started, they were 100% fully about educating as many people as they could about finance and about helping them, you know, beat the system, for want of a better phrase. But I asked Grant, when are you going to bring on anyone about Bitcoin? Because apparently it's not dead. And I think there's something there that I really need to start digging into. And he said, yeah, next week, look out. We're going to start dropping some episodes. And this was in the early days, 2015, maybe, when they started dropping. It only dropped like one or two episodes a week. And yeah, sure enough, on come Wences Cesares and Tour de Meester and Trace Mayer And I would watch these interviews and then I'd watch them again and then I'd rewatch them. I'm like, my God, I've missed something so huge here. And then I couldn't get enough, right? I just needed more. And that's when I found Andreas Antonopoulos and started watching everything that he did. And the rest is history, I suppose. You just start building that conviction and you start understanding little by little what this truly means. And of course, I came for the money, expecting to make mad fiat gains, because I knew if I started investing that I was beating Wall Street to an investable asset. In fact, Wall Street hadn't even created this investable asset. And that didn't compute with me because of my whole career in finance. Every other investable asset had been masterminded by some financial wizardry sitting at, you know, one of the big banks and then released onto the market. And then, hype is created around it. And that could be a new bond issuance. That could be a new, well, in my own lifetime, we were doing foreign exchange options. And then you had exotic foreign exchange options. And then you had long date foreign exchange options. So there would always be something coming out, but it was always this invisible hand behind it. Here's Bitcoin. Like, where are the banks? Where are the hedge funds? I'm like, oh shit, I can get a jump on this whole thing. Mm-hmm. They will come. They will 100% come. And then we'll make markets around every part of this, whether it's forwards, whether it's options, whether it's spot. They're going to try and, you know, stamp their authority over it one day. And there's only going to be 21 million. So I think I'll start buying some. And my favorite meme in the Bitcoin space is came for the money, stayed for the money. Because when you realize what money is, when you go down that rabbit hole and you go and read the Bitcoin Standard and you go and figure out like the history of money and all the other books that help you put all of these pieces of the puzzle together and how money is so like ingrained into our anthropology, our history, and how it lifted us from barbarism into civilization, and how it's the most important tool to express value and communicate with each other. And when you realize that, and then you realize how that's been captured, manipulated, coerced, and how we all are completely in chains to the fiat currency issuer of whatever particular country that you live in, company, same thing. Then you really stay, it all starts unwinding in front of your eyes, and your conviction over Bitcoin just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And you start looking less and less at the price, and you become a calmer person because you've seen the light, you've seen the truth. You have to go through many stages though. It's not an easy journey, as I'm sure you'd attest to.
Right. So what do you think it is that made, what is it about you that made you, I guess, open to this concept of Bitcoin? Because there are so many, anyone I know in traditional finance, just in my personal life, either will willingly admit that they don't get it, or but they don't even have the curiosity to really explore it, or they'll argue about why it doesn't have a future or why it's not going to be the global reserve or whatever without having done any research. Why, with your background, were you willing to, have you always just been sort of a skeptical type and willing to, too curious to just accept that as an answer? Or is there something else about your background that maybe led you there?
No, not really. I mean, I was just Mr. Keep your head down, risk averse, do all the right things, get the 2.4 kids, get the white picket fence. I never wanted to rock the boat. I was never confrontational. I just wanted an easy life. I was happy, you know, just living the lie, I suppose. I think that there are two main things. My level of indoctrination was way lower because I did not go to university. And when you look at the fiat bros that are out there right now, certainly from the mid to late 90s, the only way you're getting a seat at the table, at the big boy table, you know, trading for one of the big banks, the only way you're getting into finance is if you have an economics degree or a mathematics degree and some kind of even PhD probably, you know, now we have these quant traders, right? That apparently the mega brains of the world. The price you pay there is the indoctrination to Keynesian economics. So you are absolutely 100% completely blindsided by the fact that there is a whole different school of thought out there. How many of us have ever heard, had ever heard of the Austrian economic school of thought? I hadn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, not once until I started listening to Bitcoin podcasts and Stefan Levera and people like that, Max Hillebrand, and listening to these people and them blowing my mind. But at the same time they were blowing my mind, I'm like, this is so intuitive. Like, you know, and then you listen to Safe just absolutely smash down because he used to be a Keynesian economic teacher at universities, and how he can just like unravel all of that complete nonsense. You're like, whoa. So I didn't have the same level of indoctrination that many of them have. And then the other trap is, of course, you're paid well. Mm-hmm. Like, very well. And you're playing into the trap of the sunk cost fallacy as well. So you've got the 4 years that you spent at college, and you're probably still trying to pay off that debt. And you've had the 4 years of like total indoctrination to Keynesian thought. And now you're actually being paid okay, but you're still living out of your means because you've got the convertible BMW on finance, and your wife's got the mum van on finance, and you've got this beautiful, great big 6 or 7 bedroom house somewhere outside of the city, which you owe a big mortgage on. So when Bitcoin comes along and like taps these guys on the shoulder, that represents the complete opposite world, like a parallel system.
Mm-hmm.
Most people they're not ready to look at it. They don't want to look at it. Even though if they just invested in it, if they dollar cost averaged $1,000 a month into it, like they'd release themselves. You know, everybody is still sitting there dreaming of retirement and retiring early. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bitcoin would be that key. But Croesus, he wrote a great article about the yuppie elite. I don't know if you'll be able to find that article and link to that for anybody that's interested in that. Because, he is a recovering fiat finance bro, as is Andy Edstrom as well. And the three of us, we like to do a like a quarterly podcast on, you know, what's going on in that murky macro world over there. What are you guys still seeing? Because Andy's still plugged into that. And his book, Why Buy Bitcoin, was a great pilling moment for me as well, because he was someone I could look to that had come from my world. He'd worked for Goldman and Lehman Brothers. And here he is, a wealth manager, a fiduciary, writing a book about why you need to invest in Bitcoin. I was like, my God, thank goodness he wrote that book, because that was another part of the conviction. The trick with Bitcoin is you reach a level of conviction, but then the hard work is keeping that needle where it is, or pushing it a little bit further, because the minute it starts wavering and dropping down is the minute you're going to start thinking about diversifying or rolling out for some profit in air quotes. I think the other thing, the main thing that was different for me was time. I owned my time now, because I wasn't going in to strap myself in between 6 a.m. and 5 p.m. to be part of that matrix. You know, it exhausts you when you walk away. You are literally mentally drained, and you're going to go home and pick up books about Bitcoin once you've got home and you've seen the kids for an hour and a half and helped get them into bed, and then you had something with your wife, or you'll be going out with customers 2 or 3 times a week, and at the weekend you want to try and find some kind of leisure time. But that might be, you know, whatever, playing golf, playing a sport, going hiking, mountain biking, whatever it is you want to do. Or you're running the kids all over the place. So time, you don't own it. It's someone else's. So once we plugged everything, unplugged from all of that, and we started living on our own terms, I had the time to do that. I had the time to sit down and watch an hour and a half video about Bitcoin or the history of money. Or I had the time to sit and read the articles and read the books. Whereas most people don't. And that's huge.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think the other thing that I I'm curious about, and maybe I'm overthinking it, but it seems like so much of the financialization of our economy means that there are a lot of people who are making really good money, to your point, without ever producing anything useful. Like they're just playing the game very effectively to earn money. And I sort of wonder, it's like, they want to people want to feel like their life and their work has meaning. And as long as they're making money, it kind of makes them feel like they're doing something useful, even though they're never producing anything for society at large. And I sort of wonder if maybe there's like if there's like a deeper level of resistance to Bitcoin, because it's like that everything you do could be as easy as buying Bitcoin, and you could spend your time, instead of shouting numbers into a phone, you could spend your time actually building something and producing something that people demand in the marketplace. And I'm always curious, like, you know, because I've never been in finance. My financial IQ is rather low. And so I'm just curious if maybe that's sort of the reluctance that a lot of these traditional finance folks have with Bitcoins. It's like, it's too easy. I need to be able to, I need to do something that uses my degree that I got at university and uses my high IQ. Do you think that could have anything to do with it?
Yeah, it could be. And I remember actually when I was sitting at my desk and it hit me like a freight train. And I remember talking to one of my customers about this. It was going through the same kind of mind processing. It's like, what are we actually doing? I push numbers around. You push numbers around. Like, why? Like, what for? Yeah. You know, but up until that point, I hadn't questioned it because you're too busy. And money makes the world go round, right? You trick yourself into believing that you are doing something very valuable for the economy. And the economy wouldn't be able to work if it were not for, the people that were greasing the wheels of it in the background.
It's sort of an ego thing, and not to say that everyone's equally arrogant, but just you have to sort of it's like any of the Bitcoin memes, you know, you get it the price you deserve. It's a humility contest. All of that, I think, is maybe kind of what I'm thinking for a lot of these folks, and not just for them. I mean, for anyone.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I think it's cope. And when you look at the fiat world, I mean, it's not just finance. We're just talking about finance right now. But, you know, most fiat jobs are just pushing pens and papers around and like emailing this, that, and the other thing back and forth. You know, there's how much value is, I mean, especially civil servants, man. Like, wow. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what are you doing there in the office all day? Like, you know, dreaming up of where to put a traffic light or a zebra crossing or something. Like,
yeah. You know? Have you seen that chart of it's like the healthcare system and like the number of doctors is very slowly increased, but the number of administrators has skyrocketed over the last, 30 years or whatever. It's like that's the perfect encapsulation of the problem, is more and more people are doing less and less useful things because, and to some degree they're trapped. They have to, right? I mean, it's regulatory, you know, compliance issues and those sorts of things. On the other hand, I think fiat money, it does enable that and exacerbates the problem. And everyone wants to feel important and like the job that they're doing is useful. And we're probably all guilty of it until we sort of escape fiat land to some degree.
Yeah, 100%. And the same, if you look at WTF happened in 1971, they've got the same graph for the education system. And like, you know, you've got a slow, steady increase of teachers and just this hockey stick of administrators.
It's crazy. And,
but they will sit there and tell you blue in the face that they're adding value. And if it weren't for them, then, you know, you're like, yeah, but like the education system. Really?
Yeah.
Like, you think it's running okay? The health system? All right. Okay. And then in the financial world, you had like this hockey stick of compliance, right? All of a sudden, bam, everyone's got to have compliance. And then that spills over into every other sector, more compliance. And then more recently, this ESG grift. And now everyone's got to have an ESG officer on their team. And now you've just got whole swathes of industry being carved out by this ESG complete and utter nonsensical fiat dream world mm-hmm. where we have a market, carbon credit market. People are trading thin air, mm-hmm. 400 parts per million. Like but billions of dollars exchanged in fiat currency terms over carbon credits. Like it's absolute insanity that like what fiat breeds.
It wouldn't be possible without cheap money. None of what you just described is possible without cheap money. Because if you have to compete with someone else who has no advantage to the, you know, no access to the money printer, you're going to fire everyone you just mentioned. You're never going to create the positions in the first place. But if tomorrow you had to compete on that level on an equal playing field, ESG, half of human resources, like all of the, you know, compliance, all these people, their jobs would just vanish.
Yep. And think about entrepreneurs, small to medium sized enterprises, family businesses. When you are going up against the the government are competing in the labor market, they get to set the regulations. They get to screw around with the amount of currency that is in circulation. They get to set how much you pay your employees, and they get to set brand new jobs out of nowhere that you have to fill. And how on earth could you ever expect a business to run and compete against that? It's just how we've got here is just incredible, to be honest. The sooner we can get away from it and get on a sound money standard, a Bitcoin standard, the better. It will go away. It will get better. But, we need more people educating. We need more podcasts. We need more YouTube videos, books, articles, whatever, conferences, meetups to help people understand. Because otherwise, this thing is just going to drag on and on and on. And it's only going to get worse. It won't get better.
Yeah. Well, you brought up the topic here that I really want to dive into with you, the growth of the administrative function of the education system. So how did you, was it the 4-hour work week that got you interested in homeschool? Like homeschooling or whatever you want to call it became mandatory because you wanted to live this life of travel and sort of reset your pace of life. Is that how the homeschooling began?
Yeah, that was the kind of kickstart. It's like, right, okay, if we do this, like let's say we go traveling for 6 months, what does that mm-hmm. look like? And I was still in such a normie mindset. It's like, whoa, like 6 months, the kids out of school for 6 months, they'll be so far behind. It's just so retarded now that I think about it. But behind what? Behind who? Who should ever have the rule of thumb to be able to tell you where your child should be in relation to anybody else? To have this idea that little Johnny should be able to read by five these four books and comprehend them. And if they don't, then there's something wrong. But if they do, and then they can read a little bit more than that, then they're special. Like it's just complete and utter nonsense. But that's the kind of, the first dark kind of thoughts that we've had to start unpacking is like, what does it mean for really the kids if we take them out of school? And it's like, okay, well, let's find some resources. Let's look around. So this was back in early 2014. And you start looking about, and the first thing we found was the TED Talk by Sir Ken Robinson, which is titled, Do Schools Kill Creativity? And he delivered that talk in 2006. And today, it's still the most downloaded and widely watched TED Talk of all time. Number one. Like, it's unbelievable. If nobody's seen it, please go back and watch it. And poor old Sir Ken has passed away since. But he did incredible work. He wrote some books as well. Your Child in School, Finding Your Element, and one other is escaping me right now. But watching that video was huge. And then I found he had another one as well, which like followed it up, and it's like, wow, okay, that's just smashed down a lot of worry right here. And then you find other people just by digging around. It's like, okay, well, who's this John Taylor Gatto guy? and you read, the best place to start with Gatto's work, Weapons of Mass Instruction. That is just the biggest truth bomb, because John was a, like Saken. Saken was a professor, university level, and John was a state teacher in New York. He'd been 30 years working in state schools around New York and had won numerous accolades and awards, including Teacher of the Year for a couple of years. But then he wrote an article, I Quit, I Think, which was run in the Washington Post, if I'm not mistaken. And that started blowing the lid off everything about what had been going on in the education system and how it was put together. And he goes into that here. This is a huge book, man.
Like, okay.
Even if you might not even be able to get it anywhere. I don't know if I'm mirrored, maybe there.
You're good. You're good. That's okay.
The Underground History of American Education. And when you realize how the education system was captured and why it was put together and the way it is still run today, oh, it's not broken.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's working perfectly fine. It's working as designed.
Right.
And poof, the penny drops. You're like, oh, shit. Yeah. Let's just walk away from that for a little while then. And let's see what happens. You know, what's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. The worst that can happen is we all go off traveling. We do it for 6 months. We don't particularly like it. We just go back, get rehired, put the kids back in school. But if we don't take a look, then how will we ever know? And and sure enough, off we went. 6 months become 9 months, 9 months become a year and a half, become 2 years, become 2.5 years. And world schooling is what we ended up kind of calling it. And there's a shit ton of other families out there doing exactly the same thing. Whether you're traveling or whether you, you could be traveling the world, or you could just be traveling around your own county or your own country. But the idea being that your kids aren't hemmed up in school all day, and you as a family can go and explore. There are different ways of doing this now. People can work remotely way more than they used to be able to. For us, it was more of a sabbatical whilst I was trying to figure out, like I said before, you know, how do we keep our savings? And that you just kind of lean into it and work out what works best for you. That there's no one way of doing it. One way of homeschooling, in air quotes. And what, you know, the picture most people envisage is, you know, the kids sat down straight backs at the kitchen table with mum or dad at the front of the table with a whiteboard, right? Okay. And we're going to do this today and trying to rote learn stuff. Nonsense. That's not how learning happens. That's what they do to you in the indoctrination camps. And that does not work at home in a family setting. What works is way more natural and trying to put faith back into the learning process and faith back into the fact that, you know, the child is learning every single second of every single day, as we are as humans, as adults. You know, like, how much have you learned since studying Bitcoin? There's no Bitcoin course. No one forced you to go and start learning about Bitcoin. You started picking up books, something piqued your interest, and you, because you're an adult, you can go find the tools that you need. Kids, they can't find the tools all the time, but that's what a parent's there for. That's what the adult is there for. He's like, ah, I see you've got an interest in drawing. Okay, I'll go find some art supplies. All I got to do is put that in front of you and let's see. Where does this? I see you're like trying to play music on the desk, or the, you know, let's go get a cheap drum set, or let's go find a guitar. Like, you, that is just let them learn, let them explore. But this idea that you've got to put kids for 5 days a week with 29 strangers for 7 hours a day sat in classrooms doing low grade clerical work is absolute insanity. That does not work for the kids. That does not work for the teachers. That does not work for the families.
Yeah.
It does work for people that want to try and control you and turn you into very obedient little automons when you come out.
So what are, I want to dive in a minute into sort of your, like how you've approached this more specifically. So like, you know, when you and your wife wake up and it's, you know, you're working with your kids or you're engaging with them or teach, like, how does that happen? I do want to take a step back though and just understand. So like for the last couple of years, my daughter has been at a preschool, just a couple days a week, couple hours in the morning. And it's a school that whose values align with ours. I have no concerns about like the indoctrination, you know, concerns you might have in many schools. But at the end of the day, my concerns are more like, what the hell is she learning? And is it going to be useful? And if they are going to teach her something useful, she, you know, she's a reasonably bright kid and you've got to, you know, work to the lowest common denominator. And so she could be soaring while they're kind of just staying in the lanes of this particular instruction and whatever. You can't, even in a small class of, you know, eight kids or whatever, which I think is about what she has, it's just, it's not useful. I'm curious though, let's take it as a given that the government run schools are a disaster, which is most of what I grew up in, at least through high school. What would your concern be with like even a good private school? Is it just sitting down for 7 hours a day? Is it, I mean, I'm sure yes, but like what are your concerns kind of with traditional education more generally?
Yeah. So with the private schools, you've got to ask yourself, you know, what is the curriculum compared to the state school? You'll find generally it's very similar. Mm. And if that's the curriculum, then who creates the curriculum? Like who gets to decide what that age group gets to learn, has to learn? Like there's no question, you have to learn this. And, you know, that's where the propaganda comes in. That's where the indoctrination comes in, because you're trying to build nationalism, patriotism to the country, to the government. And this is where, like, you know, you'll have all of history lessons. How much history have you managed to unwind since learning about Bitcoin?
Yeah,
and you've gone back and rethought everything that you were ever told in any history lesson growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in every capacity of my education, I've rethought what I once held to be just self-evident.
Right. So a private school versus a state school, if those curriculums are pretty much the same, what are you buying? To me, it's kind of, wow, okay, you're going to pay 15, 20 grand a year for your child to go to school to get the same indoctrination. It might be a little bit fluffier. They might be around slightly wealthier families. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, huh, so am I just buying a network? Like, you know, does that feel right?
Mm.
But they're still trapped in like 5 days a week, 7 hours a day, and they still have the pressure and they still have the stresses and they still have the traumas. And you've got to remember, these are very young people. These are very young minds. Push everybody to read this book. It's called Hold On To Your Kids by Gabor Mate. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Dr. Gabor Mate. And he goes into it, you know, why parents need to matter more than peers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all about the breakdown of the family. And this is so true. When you think about if you're giving your child up to whether it's a private school or whether it's a state school, you're giving your child up at the age of 5 to be brought up by the peers that they're surrounded by, 15 to 25, 15 to 30 other kids, and one flapping head at the front of the room that is being told what to teach, when to teach, how to teach, and why to teach it. I don't see too much difference between a private school setting and a state school setting.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. The only for me, I think there's so much non-educational nonsense that happens in a typical government-run school nowadays that I think can be avoided in a good private school, and you know, with where you can be more assured that your values do align. But I think at the end of the day, that's been my concern with it's like I simply don't care about the stuff that they're teaching or that they would teach my daughter if we sent her to that school. Like she's not gonna learn Austrian economics. She's not gonna learn about Bitcoin. She's not gonna learn about all of the things that like will completely shape her ability to think as an adult. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the ultimate miss. Like she hasn't been educated, you know, no matter how long you do it, it's still not education. Yeah. It's just nonsense.
What are they going to tell her? Well, they're going to tell her the planet's going to fall out of the sky. They're going to tell her it's humans that have created, you know, this awful, unlivable planet. You know, we should all be ashamed of ourselves and you know, hate yourself for being a parasite on this earth. Mm-hmm. And, going to question whether or not you're a boy or a girl. Like this one has been the last, you know, this random push the last 3, 4, or 5 years. And and not only that, be shamed into, you know, medical procedures, let's just say, mm-hmm. injections of God knows this, that, and the other thing, which you might be 100% against. Mm-hmm. But then if you've got a 13-year-old kid that's now surrounded by other 13-year-old kids, again, you know, why parents need to matter more than peers? Well, you know, look back at COVID, what was going on? How many kids' parents didn't want them to have this injection but ended up going and getting it because, oh, well, all my friends have got it. Like it's such a control mechanism. Like the people that play these psyops on us, they know what they're doing. And the school is the best place. Like when John Taylor Gatto talks about it, like the school is the best place to start really going in and the mind control and the crowd control and the mass psychosis. As wow, what was his name that came out on Joe Rogan and started talking about Robert Malone, as he was explaining. Mm. You know, it's the breeding ground is getting all of people marching in the same unison, looking the same. Look across Europe, most that's not true. In the UK, certainly 100% in the UK, most if not all schools now are a full uniform. Now I am talking dress shoes and full suit on an 11-year-old boy, yeah, on an 11-year-old girl with a tie and a blazer. Like what?
Yeah.
Why? What on earth could that, how would that help like that child learn something?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. It's called uniform for a reason, right? One form. You ought to look the same. You ought to stand up together, sit down together, move on the bell together. And this is it. This is how we build a good working democratic society, mm-hmm. in a top-down totalitarian, authoritarian regimen for 15 years of your life, all wearing the same thing. Like, you know,
yeah,
there's nothing more communist than a school. Believe me.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company. It's funny because it's like one of those things that we all accept as normal because it's what most people have known. But hearing you talk about the education system is sort of like hearing Saifedean talk about our economy. You know, it's like when you just begin to point out like what is actually happening instead of accepting it at face value. Mm-hmm. It's so blatantly obvious how contrived it is. And honestly, whether it's nefarious or malicious, and there's malicious intent or not, doesn't matter. Like the net result is that it's just like this evil being done to so many kids.
Yeah. So I'm going to read you the General Education Board. Have you ever heard this about this before?
No.
Okay. The General Education Board. This is Wiki, right? And you can even just go to their own website and read about it. Mm-hmm. Was a private organization which was used primarily to support higher education and medical schools, right? So you're capturing just normal education and medicine in the United States. Right. So the board was created in 1902. Who do you think? I'm just going to give you one guess here. This board was put together with an initial donation of $1 million. So it's a privately funded board. And the formation began in early 1902. It was founded, a small group of men gathered at a secret location to discuss education. It was funded with $1 million.
I'm thinking someone with the last name Rockefeller.
Oh man, that's all you needed, right? One guess, bam. So John D. Rockefeller funded the General Education Board with $1 million in 1902. I mean, like, why would you, what is bringing you to that meeting? Why are you sitting there thinking, all right, okay, why? Because you can, if you capture, like, they didn't need critical thinkers. They needed, like, obedient workers. And when you go down to, like, the philosophy, this was written, it's called the General Education Board Occasional Papers Number 1, The Country School of Tomorrow. So this is the philosophy. This is, like, the white paper, the abstract of the General Education Board in 1902. So they hadn't captured the money system yet, but the same people, the same kind of characters were capturing the education system already in the United States, right? It reads, in our dream, we have limitless resources and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from their minds and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have an ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple, as well as a very beautiful one. To train these people as we find them to perfectly ideal life just where they are. So we will organize our children into a little community and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. In the homes, in the shops, and on the farm. Man, that's their fucking...
Yeah, that's wild.
They're not even hiding it. It's right there. Anybody can go and figure this out for themselves. And how far have we strayed from that original white paper? Like, we haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the 21st century equivalent. It's just the evolution of what they intended all along. I think.
And so if we look at a timeline of human history, let's say, like, that's the timeline of human history from here to here. Mm-hmm. Like, the education system, if this is like year zero, mm-hmm. all of humanity, education system, like, there.
Yeah.
Man.
Just
showing up. So we're only like 3 or 4 generations deep into this hell.
Yeah.
And we've got to stop it. And we, like, when, you know, as Bitcoiners, we want to, you know, we stop feeding the beast, right? Or libertarian people, they want to stop feeding the beast because they understand that every time that, like, they bow or they send their tax dollars or whatever else, that they're validating the very thing that is completely all and consuming everybody of their time and sanity. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're feeding the beast our kids' hearts, minds, and souls.
Yeah.
Voluntarily. We're walking them to the front freaking door at the age of 3, 4, or 5. And then ushering them across the threshold, a gate which gets locked behind them as soon as they walk across. Like this, as Neufeld and Marte will tell you in their book, the trauma, the psychological damage that happens to a young child. The young child has no idea why that morning their parents got up, put them in the car, took them to this place and said goodbye. You know, there's no amount of, oh, don't forget little Johnny, you're off to big boy school on Monday morning. That's just words in one ear and out the other. Like he's playing with his cars and toy soldiers on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday doing family stuff. And then Monday, nope, right, life's changed over here. This great big indescript building, awful government looking box building, gray, full of just complete strangers. And your mother says, all right, have a good day. Off you go. How many times have you seen kids crying, walking away from their mothers across a playground?
Mm-hmm.
And then look at the trick that's been played on like the staff. You know, there's a 27-year-old teacher, lady, comes out, takes the child by the hand, and instead of walking it back to its mother, walks it further away because she's been trained to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
This is inhumane stuff. And people might think that's, you know, me getting all, like, hyperbolic over this. But, like, read the books. Like, here's another one. Naomi Fisher, Changing Our Minds. She's a clinical child psychologist. Now, she started speaking out, and the preface is by Peter Gray, another great book, Free to Learn. Now, it was her job. She worked within the system, and I've had all of these authors except Gabor Mate on the podcast, so you'll be able to go back and find them. She was, as a clinical child psychologist, she was working within the system in the UK under the NHS to diagnose children with ADHD or ADD. And it suddenly hit her. I've got a 2-year waiting list outside of my door. What the hell is going on? And these kids that come and sit in front of me, they're just kids. They fidget because they're kids. And they've been bored sitting in a waiting room. But I've got the mother in tears telling me he can't sit still at school. He's always looking out the window. He's disruptive in class. He always, you know, he's always getting in trouble. There's something wrong with him. And it was her job to either diagnose with ADHD or say, no, the kid's fine. But the parents would be begging for the diagnosis because the system has crippled the family into believing that there's something wrong with their son or their daughter, and they just need the diagnosis so they can get the drugs to calm down the kid. Calm down the kid? So it can sit bored in a classroom with 29 other strangers it doesn't want to be in with.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for Naomi and her work, because she really nails it and she speaks out against what's going on. And again, man, it all comes back to broken money. And the original incentives of the people that set this up. It's dark. Yeah. It's dark when you go down the rabbit hole. And for anybody listening thinking, you know, that my kids are fine, they seem fine, we've been through it ourselves. You and I are traumatized by that system.
Mm.
It's inescapable to have not been.
Yeah,
and as many of us think, yeah, my schooling days, they were fine. Like there's stuff in there in your subconscious that you know one day is going to come back.
Yeah,
and we've all been subjected to it.
If nothing else, I just look back and I think about the wasted time, you know? Like I'm fortunate. I have a good family, stable relationships. I'm happily married, 3 sweet kids. But I look back and I like, and this is kind of the, especially for my son. I mean, I want the best for all of my kids, but like as a man and looking at, like, I think about all the things I want my son to know and understand and be able to do and to be capable of. And it's like, it's not only unachievable in any sort of tradition in sort of the traditional world in which we live, it's counterproductive, right? I mean, I want him to be strong and capable and competent and to know what to do with whatever he faces and to be able to figure it out, right? And it's like, to your point, you know, what was the general board? By design, they're teaching him the opposite, to get in line and to fulfill whatever duty someone else has for you. And it's sad. So do you view your, like, it on one hand, it feels like you've sort of completed your mission within your family, like you're doing it the right way and you've completely bucked the system. Do you have like a broader mission though? I mean, is the reason you're talking to me today just because you're like, hey, yeah, sure, I'm a nice guy and I'll talk to you and help you, you know, sort of think through this? Or are you thinking about how do we, like, kind of like, if you know, is it Callie Means? He's like the food. He's on a mission to bring down big food and to get us back to proper ways of eating. Do you sort of view yourself as that for education, or are you kind of like, everyone else can figure it out, I'm just going to kind of preach what I, you know, what I did?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many great people, trailblazers, that are doing incredible work. I've spoken about many of them already. There's another one, Corey DeAngelis. Again, he's been on the show. He's been on Safe's show as well. And Safe and Corey and I, we did a panel in Miami 2023 about the education system. And he's a real trailblazer. I mean, and he doesn't even have kids.
Like, he doesn't have kids. I didn't know that.
No, he's newly married. But he's been like, he got pilled by John Taylor Gatto and the work of others as well that came before us. So I have my own book, right? Choose Life. And that is all about our journey and how we did it and how we put these pieces of the puzzle together and why we did it, and, you know, the decisions we faced and the challenges we faced and the successes we faced. I hope that my story, our story, just brings just one little piece of confidence to another family, one little piece of conviction that, what, like, the best story I've ever had is two nice stories. One was a young girl, 12 or 13. We were at a World Schoolers meetup, just like you have Bitcoin meetups, you had World Schooler meetups as well, in Spain, in this tiny little place called La Herradura. And it's where a lot of people go and camp. And we had got an Airbnb and we were just like plugging into some of the events and whatever else. And we were on the beach. Kids were playing frisbee with all the other kids. You know, immediately other kids get on with each other because there's none of this weirdness. Like, they don't even ask how old each other are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, like when you go to a Bitcoin meetup, nobody ever asks, like, what do you do for a living? You know, that's for the freaking stupid cocktail fiat parties, right? You know, Bitcoiners, you turn up like, yo, how you doing? What's going on? What do you think about this? Blah, blah, blah. And you're chatting about, like, goodness knows what within seconds. That's what homeschooled, unschooled, world schooled kids are like as well. So they're all running around doing their thing. And we're talking to a couple of parents. And one of them suddenly twigs. He's like, oh, wait, you wrote Choose Life. I'm like, yeah, that's us. That's me. That's the fam. Like, yeah, we're here. He's like, oh my God, that was awesome. That got us moving. That's great. And then he calls his daughter over and he said, hey, look, this is Daniel. She's like, all right, yeah, nice to meet you. My name's so-and-so. I'm like, yeah, nice to meet you too. How old are you? She's like 13. And he looks at her. He's like, he wrote the book. And she looked at me back and looked at him and then looked at me back, like, the book? And then I looked at him. I'm like, the book? Like, what book? And she's like, you wrote Choose Life? I'm like, yeah, that's us. That you've just been playing with my kids. She's like, oh my God, thank you so much. If it wasn't for my dad finding that book, I would still be stuck in this school. I hated school. It was affecting me so badly. And I'm like, wow. That book rescued a kid from, like, a really dark place that she was in. And now she spends all day with her mother and father, and they travel around in a camper van, and she gets to study what she wants to study, and she gets to hook up with kids, like-minded kids, when they go to these conferences and events and all over the place. And they'd figured it out as a family, I think, and changed his life, changed his role, changed whatever. And you just do, because, you know, what's the most important thing to you? Is it your kids' grades that you are secretly hoping that they get so you can talk about it and boast about it with, you know, your social construct? Mm-hmm. Or are you worried about the actual well-being of your child?
Right.
And how do you help bring them up to be the person that they are supposed to be? You know, if we were all given that, where could humanity be, mate? For the last 150 years, we hadn't locked kids up for 15 years, between 5 and 20. None of us would be the person we are today. We would all be completely different. And we would, contrary, and this is what you said in the General Education Board, right? Imagine giving a kid the time, instead of that 7 hours a day that they're locked up in a classroom, the time to lay down and look at the clouds in the sky and philosophize, or write, or sing, or create music, or play whatever sport that you wanted to play. Mm-hmm. Everything would look so different.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. The opportunity cost is beyond measure for what we've done to millions and millions of kids over the last however long, right? First of all, that's an awesome story. I imagine if I had been in your shoes, I'd be crying that I, you know, that this kid's like, you're the guy who saved me. Like, that's such a cool thing.
It was a goosebump moment.
Oh, I bet. Hey, do you have a couple more minutes? Are you good on time?
Sure.
Okay. Well, so that would have been a great place to wrap up the show, because it's an awesome story. I have some more sort of prescriptive questions to ask you, though. I'm just curious. So, like, what would, like, a normal day of homeschooling, world schooling, if you're at home, let's say you're, or I guess if you're on the road, there's some level of education that you have to help facilitate, because your kid might just be like, I'm not going to read. I don't want to do anything. And they're just going to literally play all day. Mm-hmm. And I want them to learn Austrian economics at the very least. So what sort of your approach to bring in some level of structure, I guess, to like the education process?
That will absolutely depend on the child, the family. I mean, we have four, right? No day looks the same. There are some online, school's not the right word, learning platforms, I suppose, which they choose. So it's OutSchool. And there's another one called Kubrio, KUBRIO. And they choose like the subjects that interest them. And then they'll show up to like the online classes. They're like 45 minutes long, and figure out pretty quickly first few weeks whether or not it's going to be something that they gel with, whether this was a bad decision, I actually don't want to learn about this, I'm not vibing with the teacher, not vibing with the other kids on the class. So there's a little bit of maneuvering, trying to find the things. But now, like, just this afternoon, my daughter's just finished the philosophy class, which she loves, and she's got a psychology class as well, which she loves. Yesterday I was doing a class with my son where it's about generations. So the teacher said, go grab a parent if there's one close by. And we sat there on the thing and we were just like talking about different generations, did a little quiz. So there's tools. The other thing you can do is hire outside help. So we have a French tutor that comes in once a week to sit with our twins. I have a math tutor who I pay with Bitcoin. Big shout out to Andy.
Very cool.
Another family, actually, the Weeks family, Ben G. Weeks on Twitter. They homeschool. They do the same with their daughter. And she actually has her own Lightning wallet now. She's got a teacher teaching her Spanish in El Salvador. Pays with Bitcoin after the lesson. Andy, the same math teacher. And I can't remember. Maybe music or art teacher. And it's great to see more and more Bitcoiners as they release themselves from the fiat system. There's a couple of teachers in the UK that are doing this. They're Bitcoiners. And they're like, no, I can't. I just can't do this to kids anymore. Like, there's no way. I signed up to be a mentor and I want to mentor kids. I don't want to indoctrinate them, you know, 30 at a time, you know, 6 hours a day, just rotating through them. The same thing, you know, think about how bad that is for like somebody that was actually born to mentor kids.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's not the way to do it. So they're escaping the system and offering their services to people like us, to the homeschool crew, the homeschool, the world school, the unschool people that are looking desperately to find these teachers and interact with them. The other way, a lot of people are like, well, what about the qualifications? They'll never be able to get a job. And that kind of nonsense. But, you know, if you want the qualifications, it's easily done. My daughter, she's 16. She has 7 GCSEs. The first GCSE she got at the age of 13 passed French, right? She can speak French. So why don't you sit GCSE French? Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. The year later, why don't you do like English and math now? So she's just working through it at her own pace, online with tutors, which we've signed up for and pay for. It's not crazy expensive either. And so she's gone through, and then you take them to like each year there'll be the exams. You have different exam centers, and you just pay like 50, 60 bucks and you enter the exam and they sit the exam. The papers get taken away and then they get marked. And then there's no stress on her at all.
Yeah.
Whereas if she's in a school setting, it's like, right, all 9 GCSEs have to come and be sat in the same 2 weeks in a freaking boiling hot, sweaty gymnasium, whether you're sick or not, whether you've had a family like trouble or, you know, goodness knows what could have happened. Like, you know, the way they do these exams, you work for 5 years from 11 to 16, and then it all comes down to that final 2 weeks. What if you have a death in the family? And like, you know, a grandparent passes away or something. Like, your mind is up in the air. And the stress and the pressure and the trauma, because you've been told for the last 5 years, if you don't get your grades, you'll never be able to go to college, and you'll never be able to get a good job. The rest of your life depends on this. Man. And the parents get tricked into saying that shit too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so damaging.
Yeah. That's the,
I've gone off on another rant. So basically, the trick to homeschooling, unschooling, world schooling is slowly, don't get over your skis. Don't beat yourself up. De-school yourself as a parent before you go into it. Mm-hmm. That is the truly most important thing. And these books will help. These resources will help. I'll give you a reading list, which you can copy paste for the show notes. I'll give you a list, a tweet thread of all of the authors of these books that I've had on and talked about this and other people as well. Do that first. And then, slowly start thinking about, you know, it's a choice, right? You should have the option. Some countries you don't. These are your kids. This is your family. It should be up to you how you bring them up, not someone else.
Yeah.
Not someone else coming to the door at like the age of 3. Like, all right, okay. Rumor has it you have a daughter, the age of 3, maybe 4. They're ready for kindergarten now. So make sure that they're here by Monday morning. And they're going to have to come with us and they're going to have to learn this and they're going to have to wear this. And you're like, yeah, your job's over now as a parent.
Yeah, man. I hope this conversation is as impactful for my wife as it is for me. I mean, I think we're both very much on board with, and so actually, well, I'd be curious. I think we're both very much on board with homeschooling for philosophical reasons. Which of those books would you say are maybe more tactically useful, because I don't need to be convinced of, like, your gospel resonates with me. I'm more curious, okay, like, how do I go about this, structure it well, make sure it's productive? Yeah. Which are there, like, 2 or 3 maybe that you're like, yeah, these will help you, give you an idea, like, how do you execute on this new adventure?
I'd say the best thing to do would get onto your local Facebook groups or whatever else and find your community. Mm-hmm. Because there's one hiding out there and you just haven't found it yet, most likely. And get along and go and speak to them and go and understand and go and ask them, you know, what worked best for you, and go and meet the kids.
Mm.
That's like that. That's irreversible. When you meet the kids, when you meet the homeschooled kids, any age, like 12, 13, 15, 17, you're like, whoa. 8, it doesn't matter. Like when you meet the homeschooled kids, you're blown away. It's like, huh? I just spent an hour talking to a 9-year-old. This is the kind of thing that happens to us in the conferences when we take the kids to the conferences. They're like, I just spent an hour talking to your child. Like, how old is she again? Yeah, she's 13 now. Like, wow. And you like, that doesn't happen at home. Like, no, because let me guess what happens at home. Even like, you probably go see your niece or your nephew. Oh, how are you? How are you? Yeah, great. How's school? Yeah. What's your favorite subject? PE. Yeah. All right. What do you want to be when you grow up? Nah. Well, yeah, I don't know. All right, run along. See you in another month or so. Like what is that?
We underestimate the capacity that kids have. I mean, you can answer the question about the books. I was just going to comment that, like, your daughter, when she is it Lauren, she gets on your podcast and asks the first question, and it's always a thoughtful question, and she always seems very comfortable talking to someone who might be a very high IQ, you know, developer or someone who's accomplished a lot. And like for her, it's like, it doesn't matter. This is a person. This is an adult. I can engage with them. You know, it's just pretty cool. But anyway, recommendations for like the tactics, I guess.
The tactics. I think there's one back here.
You've got a library of resources.
Yeah, I do. I thought I had it out. There's one by, it's called Why Are You Still Sending Your Kids to School?
It's a good title.
Yeah. it smacks you. Why am I blanking on his name?
Here, I'll look it up.
Blake Bowles. Found it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. I see it.
Because that gets you questioning.
Yeah.
And that really starts helping you. And he does have some good tips in there and what to do. And, you know, but otherwise, like I said, definitely getting face to face with people, mm-hmm. Because they will have all the tricks, tools, and tips for your area specific to you. They'll know the math tutor. They'll know the chemistry teacher. They'll know this, that, and the other thing, whatever you need. They'll know like the homeschool sports teams, you know, that have popped up out of nowhere, you know. Yeah. And another one would be Free to Learn by Peter Gray. And that's a good book as well for people that are looking for that.
Okay.
Extra kind of, yeah.
Man, you've
conviction.
You've added a lot
again,
to my
another
reading list.
Psychologist.
I love it. Okay, hey, so last question for you. So I've been toying around on the podcast with like I'd love to have like a final question to ask that's interesting. And so my question to you, I want to see if maybe this one resonates and other people find interesting. And that is, what is an unpopular opinion that you hold? And I'll give you bonus points if it's unpopular amongst Bitcoiners, because I think most of the opinions you hold are unpopular amongst your average law-abiding citizen. Anything goes, but if it offends some Bitcoiners, you get some bonus points.
Oh, good one. No spam on the blockchain. Absolutely none. Mm. I think it's abhorrent. I think just when you think we're actually fixing the money, all of this nonsense starts sneaking onto the blockchain and bloating the UTXO set. Mm-hmm. It literally should just be a ledger to track transactions. That is what sound money is. Why we want monkey JPEGs or any of this other nonsense on there is just completely and utterly beyond me. And no, it's not a free open market, and the open market will decide, and it's good for miners, and all of this kind of language that come along with the release of these things. And you know, if you go back to WTF happened in February 2023, that is a website that you can go find, and I've got a podcast on it with Bitcoin Mechanic and Giacomo Zucco, who you know, they've been around a long time and they've seen this action before. And when I started following the money behind Taproot Wizards, when they started with all the ordinals and whatever else, you can follow the money back to the big blocker dudes that are funding this kind of nonsense. They literally are spamming the Bitcoin blockchain. And I don't know the answer, but I do know we need more awareness and we need more people waking up to it. And those people that do have the answer can get ahead of it because it's very damaging and it's very sad to see. But I know a lot of people that they're happy to bury their heads in the sand and Bitcoin, you know, it's fine. It's all going to be good. Don't worry about it. It needs more thinking about, and people I think need to take a closer look.
Yeah, well, that's probably a good unpopular opinion. It's not unpopular with me. I couldn't agree more. And love Bitcoin Mechanic. We just he was on our pod and always brings the heat. Love what he's doing as well in the space. So, Daniel, I could probably ask you 1,000 more questions. I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up, though. I appreciate your time. I've got tabs pulled up with these books. I've got a big trip coming up, so I'll be reading many of them, including yours. Why don't you give a handoff? Where can people find you? You've got an awesome podcast as well. Maybe share a bit about that.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for everything that you guys are doing as well with your education push, trying to help as many people about Bitcoin as possible. It's very, very important, especially the noobs that are coming in. There's a lot of language here that is not easily understood. So unpacking all of that is very important. So if you want to find the book, Choose Life, I point people to, I'm going to be in Prague signing copies. So if anyone's coming to BTC Prague, come over to the Consensus Network booth, find me. And if I'm not there, just grab a copy and I'll sign it if you come up to me at any stage. You know, I'm always available. And you can use the code BITTEN. If you're going to BTC Prague, you'll get 10% discount. Go buy the book from bitcoinbook.shop and support a Bitcoin-only company. That same code applies. If you use the code BITTEN, you get 10% off. And if you pay with Bitcoin via the Lightning Network, you get another 10% off. So if you go shopping on bitcoinbook.shop, don't just get one Choose Life copy. Get one of Knut's books or Seyfarin's book or, you know, whatever. And they've got many different languages as well. So gift books, get some and gift them out. And my podcast is called Once Bitten. And like you said, my daughter asks the first question of each show. And she's been doing that since she was 9. And so she's 13 now. So we've been at this for over 4 years. And yeah, you'll find everybody that you want to hear from on there. And not just Bitcoiners, because like I said, I've had a lot of these authors on talking about homeschooling, unschooling and their books and their work and their field of expertise, like Naomi Fisher being a child psychologist. So it's gone, all over the place. And I love getting just plebs on the show. You know, yes, you will find Michael Saylor, Lynn Alden, Safer Dean Amos, all of the Preston Pierce, all the big names they've been on too, but I love to focus on just the plebs that are out there doing what they're doing. Like, how's Bitcoin changed their life? Why are they on this path? How did they find it? How's it changing their thinking? You know, what are they looking to build? And I've met some of the most incredible people over the years doing that. So that's the place to find me. And on Twitter now, it's at Princey21M. If you want to come and find me on Twitter and follow my tweets. And I've been tweeting a lot recently about what I've been seeing in the skies. That's that might be another one of those opinion things. My opinion is we are living through an age of ridiculous geoengineering with solar radiation modification going on right above our heads. And nobody's paying attention to it. And everybody's just happy to lean back and, you know, point the finger and say tinfoil hat wearer and conspiracy theorist, rather than actually take a step back, look up in the sky and, you know, just admit to themselves that, that doesn't actually look right. Yeah. And try and do their own research into what's actually going on.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, you're doing some amazing work. I really appreciate you taking time. Appreciate everything you're doing. Seriously, everyone listening, check out his podcast. You do have some amazing guests. And I think you're right. You know, we've all heard Lynn and we've all heard Michael Saylor. It's really fun hearing just, you know, your average person who's doing something cool and no one else would have ever heard about him. So, we're grateful that you bring those folks on and chat with them about it.
Thank you for having me on, man.
Yeah, man. Good talking. Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you being here. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Daniel. I loved it. I certainly gleaned a lot of information from him. I'm going to read, I have like 5 or 6 new books on my list now that I need to take a look at, and I'll probably read as I'm traveling. Definitely check Daniel's podcast out. He has one of the more interesting podcasts, very diverse range of guests, very thoughtful people that he has on, and he's great at asking questions and digging into some very interesting things. Follow him on Twitter as well. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, if you want to secure your mobile device and your home network, we can help you with that as well. We've got a very talented team with extensive cybersecurity experience. You can check us out at thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can also follow us on X at @thebitcoinway_. And then if you want to connect with me, if you have questions, comments, feedback, anything else, I'm on X as well. @TheOtherMJordan, and you can get my weekly Bitcoin Substack at blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.